From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, the podcast that encourages community, cross-cultural dialogue, and open conversation. We're thrilled to bring you the third and final conversation in our Season 12 series focusing on the children of immigrants. In today's interview, we'll be talking about assimilation, developing a work ethic, and mothering a multicultural child. My guest today is Phyllis Huang. A Taiwanese American born in Queens, New York, she was raised in northern New Jersey. She is the Global Vice President of Change and Organizational Effectiveness for PVH Corp in New York City, as well as being a wife and a full-time mother to a young son. Phyllis consults business leaders on change and transformation to ensure that employees at all levels have healthy mental mindsets, behavior, and skills to ensure success. Her position is often described as being a corporate therapist. Her experience has been with fashion, apparel, and media industries. Past companies include Gap, Levi Strauss & Co., and Viacom. Phyllis has a BA from New York University and an MA in Leadership and Organizational Psychology from the University of San Diego. She currently lives in Jersey City, New Jersey, with the Statue of Liberty as her backyard. Personally, Phyllis is super passionate about traveling and all aspects of food, learning, cooking, and eating. She is happiest when she can travel and eat. Welcome, Phyllis. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Welcome. I want to start with a little history lesson, if you would be so kind. Could you just fill us in on what I should know and what our listeners should know about Taiwan and its people?
So Taiwan is actually a small island. It's off the coast of China. It's about 110 miles off the coast of China. It actually has its indigenous people in an island, just like if you were in Hawaii or any of those other islands, you know, there's indigenous people who live there. But it was actually founded by China because it was an island off the coast of China. And at the time, Taiwan was actually under Japanese rule. And as the Chinese government was in the World War, Japan actually surrendered it to China in World War II, I think. And then at that time, actually due to, of course, communism in China, Taiwan actually, people started leaving China. So those who were kind of opposed to the government in China started fleeing to the island of Taiwan. And so they established it as what you often see, it often says ROC, Republic of China. So the difficult part of China now is that, of China, of Taiwan, is now it's been running on its own. So it's got its own government. It's got its own democracy, but China still feels like it owns it from a historical sense, meaning that people immigrated there. And so in the last 70 years, from a U.S. perspective, I think it hasn't been recognized. So it is not part, it doesn't have a seat at the U.N. I think countries around the world kind of support Taiwan, but very tentatively, because then there's the bigger looming issue, which is about China. And I think we all know that China is quite a presence in our global economy and our environment these days. There's a lot of political diffusion that happens. And so that is where my family is from. It's from Taiwan.
Okay. Thank you so much for providing us with that backdrop for our conversation. And I want to turn now to your parents. First of all, I'm curious how much politics had to do with their reasons for emigrating to the United States. I'd love to know what their lives were like in Taiwan and also how old they were when they came to the States.
So my parents' story is actually really different in a lot of cases than some of their friends and their peers. My parents actually did not know each other in Taiwan. They actually met in the U.S. They met in New York City. They lived in the same apartment building on the Upper West Side. And so they met, they actually both came to the U.S. independently. My father is a retired physician, and he actually came to the U.S. For graduate school. and to do his residency as post his medical training in Taiwan. He had done his residency there and educated there, and he wanted to do more. So he wanted to come to the U.S. for that education, to do a second residency, because coming from there, you actually have to do one here in the U.S. to be licensed. And then he continued to do his PhD and Master's of Public Health in the U.S. So he, that was his target in coming to the U.S. He actually started in D.C., and then decided to come up to New York City. And then my mother actually was very different. She came to the U.S. In her early 20s. She was from a much more wealthy family. She went to university in Taiwan and then just kind of decided, I'm just going to go travel for a bit. And she had the luxury to be able to do that. My aunt actually was here in the U.S. Her sister was here in the U.S. doing her master's. So she had actually intended to come and just visit her sister, and then actually wound up staying because she loved it. And I think she got a experience and taste of what it was like to be here, and had, luckily she had that independent spirit to go and do that. So, but in Taiwan, my parents actually couldn't be more different. Taiwan's a small island. It's literally maybe the size of New Jersey, maybe a little bit bigger, of the state of New Jersey. And my mother is from Taipei, which is the capital and the largest city in Taiwan. And she's a city girl. You know, upper middle class, just, you know, kind of had all the opportunity in life because of her family. And then my father is actually from a little further south, and he is from a really small village. He's one of 10 children, you know, much more probably less socioeconomically off than my mother. And I think he's the second eldest of 10. And so he really, again, I think when you have that many children, you know, you really have to kind of have your own grit and sort of passion in life to go do things. And that's probably carried over to my brothers and I a little later on. But that's what their life was like there. It's just very different. Like we talk about, you know, city person and country person. That's pretty much a perfect mix of my parents. And then they found each other.
What were the reactions of their families when they, as you said, when they found each other in the United States? Were your grandparents supportive of this relationship?
I think that's a really great question. So story would be, from what I've heard from them, I don't think either set of my grandparents thought that they would stay here permanently. I think the deal was that they were just there and that they would come back. So I'm sure that there was some, what do you mean, you know, you're staying there? What do you mean you're getting married? Neither of my grandparents, of course, at that time were able to come to the U.S. When my parents married. The story also goes actually that my father had actually, his parents, my grandparents had actually had an arranged marriage for him waiting. And so, you know, it's sort of unsaid, but I think there's part of it where my father really didn't want to do that. And I think it's different when you grow up culturally and there's an arranged marriage and then you have this opportunity, you actually fall in love with someone. Right. And it's a very different way. So I think for sure my father's side, there was some dissension. You know, it's much like if any of you've watched Joy Luck Club or Crazy Rich Asians, there is some of that that's actually really culturally relevant and true, which is, you know, your family has a very strong role and they believe they have a strong voice in kind of controlling your path. My mother, I think that they were sort of, she's one of four. She's the third daughter. And quite honestly, they were sort of, well, she's found someone, you know, they want to marry them off to a certain extent. And so I think that they were really thrilled with that. And my mother was also really similar too. She didn't speak any English when she came to the U.S. And when she decided to stay, she actually went to community college, to learn the language. She chose not to live with other Taiwanese friends that she knew. She had a U.S., you know, American roommate because she really wanted to learn the language. And there's lots of fun stories of that she tells us about that.
Oh my goodness! And what about your dad? Did he speak English at all when he came to the States? I mean, he was going. You know, he threw himself into this second residency. Did he? What was his English like at that time?
My dad's English was really good. My dad is an extremely smart, bright, and just super educated. You know, we hear stories and that they were told by his siblings from my grandparents when they were still around, which was, he was just super bright. So he was constantly studying. So it gets back to that kind of work ethic and doing that. So he would tell us that he would always learn English on his own. When you're in other countries, I think, you know, as far as I know, like in Taiwan, I know for a fact with my family and extended memories and cousins, when you choose a language, you know, in the US, you kind of have a choice of what language you want to take as a second language. In Taiwan, it's English that, you know, so almost all students and at all grade levels get some exposure. I don't have a cousin who's living in Taiwan who doesn't know some English in some capacity, and I think that's just the education system. So, but he kind of went off the charts. He would tell my brothers and I when we were growing up that he picked up a dictionary and would just read the dictionary from A to Z to learn words, because I also recall growing up and he had this vocabulary that just sort of blew our minds. We're like, we don't even know, how do you even know what that word means? And we use, because he literally could retain that. So needless to say, there was a high bar in terms of our vocabulary, since you have a father who read the
Well,
dictionary.
you're getting into a part of our conversation that I'm very interested in, which is your childhood. So your parents meet, they settle down, they have, as you mentioned, three kids, you and your two brothers, right?
Correct.
And eventually you settle in New Jersey. Can you tell us a little bit about those early years? What was life like in your house?
So I'm the oldest of three. I have two younger brothers. We are all 3 years apart, so three, three, and three. And I recall, and I think that this is what happens when you're the oldest. So I'm the oldest and the first girl. My first language actually was Taiwanese, believe it or not. My parents spoke it, so I actually am fortunate enough to be fluent in it. My two brothers can understand Taiwanese, but they aren't fluent in it. We all then learned how to speak Mandarin. In Taiwan, the indigenous language is Taiwanese, and then you have Mandarin, which is broadly spoken, like in China, it's a dialect.
How did you learn Mandarin? Was that through
It
classes or
was.
from your
So
parents?
we went to Chinese school. So we go to school 5 days a week, and on Sundays from 2 to 4, you went to Chinese school. And when you're growing up, the last thing you want to do, trust me, is go to school on a weekend. So my brothers and I hated it. We absolutely hated it. You get homework. You know, it's everything that any kid doesn't want to do. But what's interesting is that in the end, of course, when you look back when you're older, it's through osmosis, right? You pick it up. Then in college, I took it, and it's interesting. We all sort of bucked against it, and then actually, my youngest brother actually lives abroad. He actually lives and works in Hong Kong, and actually took time off to learn Mandarin fluently. And so, it has done amazing things for him professionally to be able to speak that. But of course, you look back and you think, oh, I wish I'd paid more attention. I work in a global role. I work with Asia a lot. I often wish my Mandarin was more fluent because I see that. But it's
Well, do
also
you ever use it? I mean, there's fluency, and then there's, you know, I can communicate with people. I can sort of hold my own over coffee. Do you
absolutely.
use it in your work?
I do use it in my work to kind of, especially when we work with Taiwan and I work with China and Hong Kong a lot. So I have enough to kind of facilitate a meeting if I need to kind of say, oh, you know, I think there's a misunderstanding or hang on, can't get into technical things. But you know, and I actually try to use it a lot with my parents still. So even today with my parents, I still speak Taiwanese with them. We are English speaking, but there are just some things, especially when you're trying to explain a concept, that I find I switch over. My husband and even growing up, my friends would laugh because, you know, we would call it Chinglish, more or less, right? You're flipping in and out of it, just like anybody who's bilingual, I think, has that ability to do so. And again, when I travel too, when I travel for leisure, or anytime we're in a Mandarin-speaking country, I use it. And it's one of those things for sure that the more you use it, the more it comes. We spent every summer in Taiwan when I was growing up. So we would go to, like, school would end, we would do camp for like a month, and then we went to Taiwan for 3 weeks. So that also helps reinforce it. And again, when you're there and you don't use it for, you know, 11 months of the year, and then you're there, you're interfacing with relatives, you're out, you do start to use it a bit more.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was part of that 3 weeks in Taiwan every summer being with family and interacting with family on a daily basis in Taiwanese?
Yes, actually in Taiwanese and in Mandarin.
Okay.
So it's interesting, it's generational. So Taiwanese as a language in Taiwan is kind of an older language. So you'll find there was a period, at least in my life and generation, a lot of younger kids and those even in my age group did not speak Taiwanese because Mandarin had really become the forefront. So when you're there, you do use it there. And then now it's interesting because Taiwan is trying to grow its independence and also really kind of be more nationalistic. Taiwanese is coming back. So, you
Yeah,
know,
I was
it,
going to say, has there been sort of a resurgence there with the local language?
absolutely, for sure. And even now, you know, I see on social media a lot here in the US, those who are Taiwanese, like you'll see it used a little bit more. And people are much more willing, I think. And it gets back to your earlier question in the beginning about politics, which is when I was growing up, we just said we were Chinese. And that was widely understood. We actually didn't distinguish for people that we were Taiwanese. I think it's probably in the last 20 years or so, maybe a little bit more, in which as Taiwan has really tried to elevate and make its voice heard, that we've been much more proud and comfortable and bringing that to the forefront.
I'd really love to ask you about the issue of assimilation and where your parents stood on assimilation. Did they want you to sort of just be one more kid in a class of American kids? Was sort of pride for the homeland important to them? Did they make an effort to keep traditions alive? Where did they sort of fall on that spectrum?
So I think it's really complex. I think it's a mixture of both. And it's a mixture of both depending on the situation in certain ways. I think from a school perspective, academically, they wanted us to assimilate. You know what I mean? Follow the rules, do what you're told, kind of be an American. And it was often hard. I think for me personally, since I was the oldest, I was the first one to experience everything, right? And so they had to kind of go with it and kind of experience. There's some trial and error with it. And it's really interesting when I look back and I look at my brothers, with each one going through their developmental phases too, was very different. By the time my youngest brother was in high school and middle school, it was full-fledged American style, right? Like there was no, and I think for me, it was much more, they didn't know, so they were much more cautious and wanting me to in some ways, be more American. And it's interesting. So they wanted me to be more American in that social way, you know, which is for a lot of just thinking Asians in general, right? We kind of, you're much more tentative, much more quiet. You kind of observe before being assertive is not traditionally a Asian characteristic, let's put it that way. And so, that was something that they really kind of encouraged us to be. But they were also very adamant about the reality is you are Taiwanese. You know, you're not part, you're not half, you full on are. And so with that, they really made a huge effort, especially not having any of their extended family around. It was really on them to maintain that. And they both were very respectful and had a lot of pride for where they came from. So we, you know, I think that is a testament by the fact we went to Chinese school since we were in elementary school. We always celebrated Chinese New Year. My parents always kind of talked about foods, and foods that are important to them for holidays and food in general. I also have two parents who are extremely foodie and who also love to travel and eat just as much as we do. And it might be a Taiwanese characteristic actually, because Taiwanese people are very passionate about our food and very serious about our food.
Ooh, I want to talk about that in just a second. We have to take a quick break, but we're going to come right back and talk about food in just a second with Phyllis Huang. Back in a second.
Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit rafsanpedro.es. That's RAFFSANPEDRO.ES. This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Phyllis Huang, the daughter of Taiwanese immigrants to America. Phyllis, as you know, we first met at college. We were college roommates at NYU just, you know, a couple of years ago. And you just said before the break, you just said, you know, my parents are foodies. I'm a foodie. We all love Chinese New Year. And I have to share with you that one of my earliest memories at NYU, because I'm from Indiana, so, you know, I never saw my parents between breaks. You know, I would fly off to New York and then I wouldn't see them until Christmas. So when is Chinese New Year? After Christmas, right?
It is. And so it's based on the lunar calendar, so it varies. It's usually end of January to early March, somewhere in there.
Okay, that makes sense. That's sort of I'm remembering it being in winter.
So your parents were in New Jersey and we were in Manhattan. So they did come in from time to time. And I remember they came in, it was Chinese New Year. And I was so excited because you guys all invited me to come out with you to celebrate Chinese New Year in Chinatown. So I mean, I look back on this and I'm like, I can't believe that. I mean, it didn't even occur to me that I was celebrating Chinese New Year with a family who had ties to this culture. I do remember that your parents knew exactly what to order. We were in this restaurant that had these little carts and they were speaking to the waiters in a language that I didn't understand. They knew exactly what to order. They plucked all these dishes off the cart. And then I also remember that when the meal was over, the way the check was rung up was based on like the size and number of all the empty plates on our table. So I had never experienced anything like that before. And then I also got to come to your house a couple times. And please share this with your mom. I don't know if she's going to listen to this interview, but your mom made the best fried rice I have ever had before or since that visit. I mean, it blew my mind. Like, my whole life has been a quest for something as delicious as your mom's fried rice. So I'd love to know if we have that memory in common. And to segue into food a little bit, was food a big part of your culture and growing up? Was that, you know, Taiwanese food, Chinese food in your home, was that a big part of your childhood?
So, oh my God, there's so much you've said in that to talk about. So yes, food is a huge piece of my childhood and upbringing. And I think, again, it has a lot to do with, so you had asked earlier about what my childhood was like. So we moved to New Jersey when I was 3, I think. And, you know, we're in New Jersey, it's the 70s, not a whole heck of a lot of other Taiwanese people that I recall, or Chinese people in general. So we moved to a town that was predominantly, you know, Caucasian and white. And there weren't Asian grocery stores. And so every month we would go to Chinatown in New York City, just like you mentioned before, and my mom would literally buy enough food of Chinese, like spices, sauces, you name it, so that she could cook for the month, basically in Chinese. And so, wow. As also context, growing up, we had Chinese food every single night. Friday was the only day that my brothers and I got excited because that was the night we were deemed able to have Western food. And that often included like ordering pizza, which is the greatest thing you've ever experienced when you're a kid who has Chinese food every single night. Or like, you know, right. Kentucky Fried Chicken, like anything just Western, just like rocked our worlds that Friday was like the night.
Did your parents eat that too? Or was it just the three of you guys?
That's a really good question. No, I'm going to say no, they didn't eat it.
You're like, I was so focused.
Who cares
on
what they were eating?
Three-piece meal. I have no idea.
Exactly. No idea what they were eating. My brothers and I just cared about us. Like, I honestly have no recollection of whether or not they ate it with us or not. You know, it was always about that. And so I think, you know, again, because they didn't, you know, there was Chinese restaurants, but it was a little bit more American Chinese food back then. Mm-hmm. You know, not far from a Panda Express, if you will. But I think as a result of that, there was such a focus on foods. My mother literally made everything. So like many other cultures, right? You want what's comforting to you. You want what you recall when you can't have it, right? Just in different places, no matter people who are expats like yourself, I'm sure there's certain times you crave something. You're like, oh my goodness, like how can I recreate that with the ingredients that I have? So
that's so well put, Phyllis.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
So well put.
There's so something about that you're trying to recreate. I mean, there's so many things that I can give examples of food. That might be a whole other podcast where it talks about just the way my mom would formulate certain things and use certain things to make them seem like the real thing in Chinese, but it was clearly not. You know, there's a lot of recipes mm-hmm. these days that kind of hacks, you know, a way to do that. And so she figured out her way of doing that. So as a result of that, food was super important in our house. And my parents also, it's interesting, in as much as they wanted to maintain the traditional aspects of our heritage and our culture, my parents are also just, you know, by the way of how they both wound up in the U.S., they're very curious about the world. And so they really also encouraged us to experiment and try different foods. And I think that's where that food piece comes from. I was thinking about that before in prepping for talking to you. I mentioned to my mother how, you know, our memories of that. And I was like, oh my goodness, Kate went to dim sum with us. So you went to dim sum in Chinatown where the carts you were describing, and they do charge you by the plate. So it, depending on what it was, so let's say it was three dumplings on a plate, they know that that plate, they've priced it out in advance already based on the ingredients of that. But yeah, it was definitely a huge part of our lives. And I think that helped formulate my passion about that as well. I'm sure there's also just a personal taste associated with that as well, just an interest in it as well.
It's, I love hearing you, you know, kind of put a frame around what I said, which is, you know, food is important, but why is it important? It's comforting. It feels familiar. It's, it gets at, you know, home or the things that, that, you know, touch you or remind you of things or bring back memories in a way that almost nothing else does. It's such a, strong, strong way of connecting, to, you know, what you know and what you remember. Did you feel proud, Phyllis, of the differences that you're describing? You know, language, food. I remember there were I remember the feeling of your house too. Like you had maybe some furniture from Taiwan or some artwork from Taiwan. Did you feel proud of those differences when you noticed that they were differences between you and your friends, or was that something that you wrestled with that was difficult for you?
Absolutely wrestled with. I think, you know, it's almost the split personality a bit, right? You go to school and you want to be like everyone else. And, you know, and I often have talked to other friends who grew up like I did. And now there's a lot of people out there who talk about this, this element a lot, regardless of what culture they came from. And then specifically within the Asian American community, whether you're Korean, Japanese, Chinese, there's a lot of discussion about this, which is, I think it's back to that assimilation question. And I think that you want so desperately to be like other people, especially when you don't see yourself out in your everyday life. And so absolutely we were, I personally was embarrassed. I actually don't know what my brother's positions were, but you're different and you want to be like the norm. You know, you grew up watching television. I'm a huge product of pop culture in general, and there were no Asian people on TV. And if they were Asian people on TV, it was very stereotypical. You know, it's a common story I hear from other people like me. We talk about watching the Brady Bunch, and you so desperately want to be part of the Brady Bunch family because it, you know, it depicts this American, albeit sort of blended family. But it is this thing that you, oh, I want to be like that, right? Because that's the norm and that's what you see. So for sure. And I think also when your kids growing up, people come over, I have friends come over, and what is normal to you in your house and confines is suddenly not normal. And you're told that by your friends, by your peers. And it's purely innocent. And I don't think any of our friends who came over, who asked questions or said it was weird, you know, I think at the, you know, young, tender age of like 8 or 10, but you feel it, you know, you're still, the emotions are still connected to it where you feel, huh? And you question, am I different? Do you not like me now? Is it weird? You know, I have vivid memories of, we would get invited. I'm sure like most people, you get invited for dinner at your friend's house. And when I would go to my friend's houses for dinner, I was blown away. So as you know, for Chinese food, often it's family style, right? So there's many dishes on the table and you take what you want. I remember going to a friend's place after school in elementary school, and everything I had given for me at dinner was on one plate. And I just thought, what? It's all on one plate? You know, you had your potatoes and like whatever it was on one plate. And I remember coming home, and the next night at dinner, I dumped everything my mom had put on the table onto one plate. Like I dumped out my rice bowl onto one plate. Cause I want, again, and those are all almost like symptoms of this desire to be like everybody else. And then conversely, when people would come over, they were, I don't know what my friends were expecting, but the food was weird to them, right? My mom made Chinese food. She's like, I'm not making separate food. This is what we're eating as a family. Your friends can eat it too. And to see their reaction, ew, what is that? Unfamiliar. Their smells, their tastes are different. I remember being embarrassed and mortified. And I think even my mother at certain places too would be like, oh, like it didn't, again, that's back to the not understanding. And so suddenly she's aware and she's like, you know, running to the freezer to grab some dumplings out or something because that's familiar. Right. It's still Asian, but it's now familiar. So she'd make those and then watching my friends dive into that. My mom would make sushi for lunch, right? And in this day and age, you're like, oh my God, if a kid got sushi for lunch, it's like, oh, you're so lucky.
I know, I'm here, I'm listening to you talk and I'm like, God, your friends were so lucky.
But you know, my mom wasn't raw fish or anything, but it was like the format of sushi, right? Rice, seaweed, and whatever. And you know, at home, I would eat that at any given moment, even though that's not Chinese, it's Japanese, but you know, it's Asian. And I would hide it because I remember kids at school being like, what is that? When you go to explain it to them that it's seaweed, again, it's the 70s or early 80s, and sushi is not the norm where most children today, like my son, totally gets it. It's fine. And I remember hiding it. I would leave it and just take pieces out and pop it in my mouth so no one would see what I was eating. Because it was embarrassing. And my mother then also did really interesting things like around Chinese New Year, she would reach out to my teacher at school and say, can I come and talk to the class about Chinese New Year? And that was her way of saying, again, to your question earlier, wanting us to be proud of who we are, and keeping that alive by doing little things and trying to, I guess, maybe normalize it, and educate people about it, even at You know, she did that a lot in elementary school. It's interesting because I found I'm doing that now for my own son.
Oh, I want to get back to your son too. I have so many questions for you about, you know, what about this next generation and how are you handling that as the mother of a child who also has this same bloodline, you know? I am having this memory, Phyllis, of being in the elevator with you in Reuben Hall in our dorm room, freshman in college. And part of this memory, I think, is coming to me because I'm sort of, you know, I'm the non-Asian kid in those memories, right? Like I would be that kid coming to your house and being like, what's this? I've never had this before, you know, or maybe not being quite that tactful, hopefully being tactful. But I remember, I think on a very subconscious level, or like it wasn't, it didn't register at all. Like all I knew was that my roommate was Asian, right? Your last name is Huang. Your facial features are Asian. And that was like the extent of it. And the closest that I had ever been to like being in a personal relationship with an Asian person was maybe like the Filipino people who went to my high school. I had a very close friend, a couple of very close friends from the Philippines in high school, but that was the extent of it. So I remember being in an elevator with you and these girls got in, and to my eye, it was like, oh, they're Asian too. Like, I had no idea that there might be any kind of like noticeable difference that you guys would be noticing, but I didn't. And I don't know, like they were kind of rude to you or something. I can't remember exactly what happened. And later, and I think I was like, why were those girls so mean to you? And you were like, well, they were Korean. And you explained to me, I don't remember what you said, and I don't remember how much detail you got into, but it was a huge eye opener for me. It was like, oh, there's a whole there's a lot of stuff that I don't understand. You know, this whole sort of it was a world that was hidden to me. And I want to go one step further and say that I remember you being very focused and driven at NYU. You were a very astute student, very dedicated. I want to know if you would say that's just simply part of your personality, who you are as a person, or would you say that your work ethic is something that your parents instilled in you?
Ooh, I think that's a really good question. I think that there's a percentage of it that's just me, and I think that that's just out of things that I'm interested in. You know, like most people, things I'm super interested in, and I see the future and what I want out of my life, or what you think you want in your life, at least when you're in college, like I was, and you were when we were like what 18, 19 years old. But I do think a lot of it has to do with my parents. Education, as I mentioned before, given the way my parents were educated, given how educated my father is, it was super important. And there's an expectations associated with that. I think as many Asian people will tell you, in our generation, you know, there's kind of that you need to make something of yourself. And there is that thing we talk about, which is an immigrant mentality, right? You have to be successful. You need to take care of yourself. You know, there's this drive that goes toward that. So I do believe that that is a real thing. And I think though, how you extract out of it. I have known people in my life, also Asian American, who have struggled with that. And then some who have attained all that, but then the other piece is missing, right? So it has to be this balance of yin and yang to a certain extent of that. So absolutely, I think that work ethic and is very much something my parents instilled in us. And I think that would be the case for many Asian immigrant families, I would think. What the outcome of that obviously is individual varies. But for sure, that was something that really was at focus. And there's this other piece too, I think, which is you don't want to disappoint. There's this, my husband is Caucasian. He's a mix of Irish, Italian, and he talks about Catholic guilt. And I think that there's something similar in that. There's definitely Asian guilt, Chinese guilt, Korean guilt, whatever it is, especially when you are bicultural and trying to figure out where you are, and your whole life has been, you grew up, you're born and raised here. There's that piece of you, and then there's the other piece of you, and trying to reconcile that can be confusing. And so you don't want to disappoint elders, and in most cultures are extremely important. And so I think that aspect too is what brings that drive. But then I think there's also that emotional piece of what's the norm and what's not, right? So my parents wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or something of that ilk. And so when we were at NYU, you and I were both kind of in the arts, liberal arts area, and it, to say the least, did not really thrill my parents. So there's a part of me that was like, really? That's what I want to do, and so I'm going to show you. And so I think some of that drive and work ethic was in part also to prove them wrong, saying I don't have to conform in that way to still hopefully be successful. And so for me, and that's probably just my stubbornness as a natural part of who I am, to be like, no, I'm going to show you I can make this work and still be successful in your eyes eventually. So I think that's where that comes from.
Yeah. Let's take another short break and we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Phyllis Huang. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. If you subscribe to our podcast and rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. I'm also hoping you'll visit our website at thelistenpodcast.com, where you can let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. You can find us on social media and check out the Listen blog, also available on our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Phyllis Huang about what it was like growing up with parents who emigrated to the U.S. from Taiwan. You are married now. You made reference to that just before the break. And as you said, your husband is not Asian. He's an Irish-Italian mix, right?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay. So I would love to know how a discussion about race and ethnic origin comes into the picture in your relationship. Is it something that you talk about? Is it something that you feel isn't an issue? What is that like?
So that is actually, it's absolutely present in our relationship. And I think actually over the past year in 2020, given what's been going on here in the US, I think it's even enhanced that conversation even more. But I think, I've always been kind of very upfront about it, right? I make reference to it, just a lot of things you and I have talked about. That's just who I am. And so I talk a lot about it, all the experiences, I think, too, that you shared earlier about us in college. And I think we're now in a world and generation where we understand that there are different ethnic groups, even within one that says Asian, just even in Indian culture, right? There's different, all those kind of things. So I think there's an awareness of that, but I think it's the next level down, right? When you're with someone in a relationship, you share those things and you start talking about those things. So I think he for sure has been exposed to so much more, even specifically. I think he may have even have said, yep, I understand what Taiwan is, but the nuances, the difference, the language, because oftentimes he'll tell the story of he knows, he just waits for his name to be said because I'm talking with my relatives or my parents, and it's in Taiwanese or a mixture. And he goes, sometimes I just listen for my name. And now he's actually gotten really good. He actually knows when we're talking about him because actually sometimes he'll answer and it's almost as if he understood what we said because he's literally picked up enough to know, which is actually quite
Right,
funny.
right.
But I think we talk about it quite a bit because, there's observations you make. I'm fully aware sometimes when we go out and I'm the only woman, or if I'm the only Asian, and I'll say certain things like, I'm the only Asian person. He'll be like, you're being ridiculous. No, you're not. And I'm like, and now I think he's much more acutely aware where he'll be someplace and he'll notice. He's given me stories and anecdotes where he's talking about and where he's able to say amongst people, actually, my wife is Asian, and be able to say that, right? So there's an awareness and I think a distinction for whatever the context of conversation he is, that it's relevant to point out, but hey, wait a minute, I understand whatever the case may be. I think then, as I mentioned, because of what's gone in the US with social and racial injustice this year, we really have that conversation. And especially then looking at our politics and what our president has done this past year to a heightened level has really brought that. We've had many numerous discussions about it. And I think that with every moment there's something else to learn. And I think he starts to see more of it. And we have really tough conversations too, which is it's a very different experience of how I see things and what he hears on television or in politics to say, not only do I feel it from somebody who grew up in the US knowing full well that I'm not white, and I did grow up in a bicultural environment that I see both sides of things. I can understand people's position and frustration and plight. And I think it's been eye-opening for him in a lot of ways. And I think, we talk about this woke moment, and I think he definitely has that. And it's really opened up a lot of interesting dialogue for us as a household. I think he's also now heightened to it as well because of our son. And what's really fascinating about that is we now have to make a lot of decisions about certain things about the environment. So there may be some, I don't want to call it scar tissue, but things that have happened for me that have become very important. I don't want my son to grow up in an environment that's sort of homogeneous. I want him to be somewhere where there is a lot of mixed race, and you can see it. He recently, like, he's really starting to understand now that he is a mix of things. I think he just saw himself as just a kid in class. And so when we talk about things now, he's starting to realize, oh, Aman Akong, which is what he calls my parents in Taiwanese, they don't look like Mimi and Papa, my husband's parents. They don't speak another language. And he'll say things like, oh, they're from Taiwan. That's why when we go there, you speak different things, right? And so he's starting to figure that out. And I think where we live, we're also quite fortunate that in his school, the ethnic diversity is so, the percentage is so high. Even his class, you've got mixed race families of all possible combinations. And so we often talk about it, even it doesn't even have to be if it's a Taiwanese, a Caucasian mix. They're all different sort of mixtures and beautiful combinations. But the common thing we talk about is how do we discuss that with our kids? Because we talk about colorblind and how they don't even get it. Maybe it's because of the age that they're in, but what does that look like? So it's definitely something we think about, even down to names. I'll share really personally, I did not change my name when I got married. And there's a piece to that is about me as well. I felt like I was Phyllis Wong for so many years and was this person. And this idea of getting married and changing my name felt weird. It wouldn't have that connection to being Asian, right? My last name is clearly a Chinese last name. And getting married, my in-laws were like, are you changing your name? And I was like, no, it's really not going to happen to keep that. My son has my husband's last name, but we actually made his middle name my maiden last name, so Huang. Because we felt it was really, for me anyway, it was super important that he have some semblance of that. And I remember being actually, my son's born, it's like 12 hours later, and you have to write his name on the gift birth certificate. My husband and I are still arguing about it because he just wanted to just give, some random middle name. I'm like, no, it has to be Huang. He's taking your last name, and I really, really need that. And it's interesting. And now my husband's kind of come around to it again and been like, oh, that was a really good call, in the sense that he now has that identity, whether he likes it or not, whether he chooses when he gets older to not honor it, pay attention to it. It's who he is. And that's really what's important to me as I look at him. And so we really try to give him that exposure of all sides, helping him understand also, you know, my in-laws' heritage and where they come. And so it's not one-sided. Of course, the Taiwanese side comes through much more, and it's much more visible and tangible for him. But we want to make sure he sees all of that. But yeah, it's definitely a very interesting moment and place to see what this generation will look like as more and more of them are from bi or even tri cultures.
Yeah, that is so interesting. I have a couple questions. One is, it sounds like you're very available when your son has observations to make or questions to ask. Are you proactive about those conversations? I think your son is six, so he's still fairly young. But, you know, he's not a baby. Like, I remember when my son was that age, and he definitely had some major questions, and he had stuff he needed to talk out, and we talked it out. Are these issues that you are these subjects that you open with him, or do you just kind of let him make the call and then you're there if he needs to talk about it? And I also want to ask you about language. I want to ask if you speak Taiwanese with your son, if your parents speak Taiwanese with your son.
So I've definitely erred more toward the letting him kind of lead that conversation. A lot of it is just out of, quite honestly, my own curiosity to see where he goes with it. It's an observation for sure that my husband and I have had, which is, do you even think that he knows? You know, like, you kind of wonder what's in his head a little bit. Occasionally he's asking, I agree with you 100%. I think as he's young, he's six, but there are little pieces that are coming out. I think now in this past year, as he turned six, we're definitely seeing more and more of it. And he's asking a lot more questions. And so he's also now a little older where you can sort of explain, and he's rational to understand those things. So I think it's going to be something really interesting that we kind of go to. There's like occasionally there are moments where I sort of kind of dip my toe in just to see the reaction, to see a readiness, right? If he is aware or not aware, to sort of guide it. In terms of language, so it's a wish for me that Jalen would be able to speak Mandarin. Taiwanese, I can come or go with, to honestly, like, I would love him to be bilingual. When actually, when he was little, after he was born, my mom was watching him about one day a week. And so we really realized, like, at the young age, so she was really making a huge effort to speak with him. And so he definitely picks up on a few words. Unfortunately, his speech was slow. And so we really then flipped, and it's been all much more English. We actually put him in Chinese school about a year and a half ago, but it proved to be a little too young. The way they were teaching sort of didn't match where he was, and the kids were a little older. So we started doing little things at home, like apps, and he was watching. I put him in front of shows. So it's definitely something that's super important to me. I want to try to make him not hate going to Chinese school like I did. We had a few battles at first when we went to Chinese school, and it was really, I think, the teaching style. Because the Chinese school actually taught in a very traditional way, and it didn't resonate with him. But it is something, a dream of mine, and I hope that he will be able to do that. But he definitely is starting to realize that and ask questions about it. I try to insert it. I wish that I could speak the language with him at home. It's interesting. He had a former classmate whose mother was Taiwanese. So not American born, but was from Taiwan. She emigrated here. Her husband's also an American Caucasian, and their daughter was also bicultural. And her daughter at the age, I remember, of two or three, was perfectly fluent. And I remember being so jealous, trying to understand like how she did that. And so she did the same thing. They went to Taiwan for like a couple months because she had the ability to do that. And one day she said to me, because we were at the playground or something, and I was like, oh my goodness, I wish I could, because I watched her daughter literally at the age of three flip from English. She would see her father and speaking English, and she saw me when she knew her mother and I spoke the same language, and she would speak me full on in Mandarin. And I saw myself in her because at that young age, she could do that. And this mom said to me, Phyllis, you need to give yourself a break. There's a difference. She's like, I'm a native speaker. It's natural for me to do that. She's like, you're American born, and that's not natural and distinctive for you because it's just not. And I thought, oh my goodness. So she gave me, she kind of let me off the hook a little bit to not be so hard on myself about it, you know, because I said, but your husband doesn't, does your husband speak, you know, Mandarin at home? She's like, oh God, no, but it's natural for her. It was not natural, even though I would tell myself over and over again, you know, speak to him, especially when he was, you know, much younger, baby, because that's where you hear, like, you know, that's when they really take it. It just didn't come for me naturally. And so,
yeah, it sounds like looking toward the future that your role, I mean, among many other things, because you're his mom, but in the language department, it sounds like your role is going to be, not necessarily being that resource, but providing access to those resources, whether it's your mom or traveling or Chinese school. I'm curious how you think your son's upbringing and opportunities will differ from your own when you look back at your own childhood, and what aspects you're trying to keep in the mix?
That's a really great question. For sure, I think he's going to have opportunities that are very different than mine. You know, my husband and I, since we're both, you know, Americans and grown up here, I think we understand a lot of what norms are and the path is and all those kind of things, where I had to kind of figure it out a little bit. So I think he will have that because he's got the luxury of that. He also has a luxury in the sense that my husband is in education, so there's that. So you kind of understand like the natural, and he's going to, maybe he'll buck against it. Who knows? But I think for sure the challenge is going to be to keep that in the forefront for him, about the cultural and the language piece of it. But yeah, it's really something my husband and I talk a lot about, which is, what is that environment we want to create for him? And it's a question, you know, we are talking about moving. We live in a really urban environment. We're in a small space. We need more space, like many people do. And so we are talking about that, which is, what is the right town? What is the right mix? What do we need in that town? What's the diversity environment like in that, aside from the norms of, you know, is it a good school or not a good school? You know, it's so much more than that. We also don't want to be too far away because we still, exactly to what you're saying, we still want him to be able to have access to my parents, and all that kind of thing. It remains to be seen. And I think it's a conversation discussion that we're having, especially as he gets older and figuring out as we go.
Well, Phyllis, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been great catching up with you, and I want to wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you so much. It was also great catching up with you, and wishing you and everybody in your family a happy holidays as well.
Thank you, Phyllis. This concludes our Season 12 series on the children of immigrants. Many thanks to Bhavneet and Taranjeet Athwal, Jackie Amesqua, and Phyllis Huang for their generous contributions. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where the Romanesque Gothic Cathedral dates to the 13th century. If you enjoyed this interview, I encourage you to check out the conversations in our very first season, which focused on women raising their children abroad. You also might enjoy Season 3, a series of interviews called Coming Home, in which we talked with couples who returned to their countries of origin when it came time to start their families, and Season 4, which focused on language. Explore the full archive by becoming a subscriber or by visiting our website at thelistenpodcast.com. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. I want to thank our producer, Lauren Lovett, and EJ Jetmore, who handles our social media. And many thanks to Lucas Munoz Jetmore for editing the show, providing tech support, and writing our theme music. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.